This is the March 22 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists today include Matt Bennett of AgMarket.net, Merrill Crowley of AgTraderTalk.com, Susan Stroud from NoBullAg.com, and Jim McCormick, also from AgMarket.net. Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Medium. It's public radio for the farming world online at willag.org. That's WILLAG.org. This week, we're coming to you from the Illinois Sustainable Aviation Fuels Conference taking place in Lisle, Illinois. Susan Stroud now joins us. She's here at the conference. Thank you, Susan, for joining us here on Commodity Week. We've not talked before. Can you give me a little background about yourself and about your company, please?
Sure. I come from a background in cash grain markets. So I spent more than 15 years working in the St. Louis River market for both ADM and then Consolidated Grain and Barge. So producer origination, everything going on barges, and then, of course, a lot of attention to exports thanks to the Mississippi River.
I do want to ask a quick question about your time at CBG and Zinno. Did you have a feeling, and we have visited the Zinno export facilities at the Gulf. Did you have a feeling of being very tied to the Japanese people because of the just on-time delivery of feed needs to them? Did that come out to you? And maybe it didn't all the way up in St. Louis.
You know, the St. Louis market is just really important because it's a large, incredibly competitive market, high volume, and you're also talking about Zinno's facility at the Gulf that is I think it's the largest single site exporting facility in the country. So, you know, they're originating, they're using far more than just the CGB bushels for their exporting needs.
So we went in 2012 on a bus trip to that particular export facility, and it was the first time that I felt really as if agriculture in the state of Illinois was indispensable to a different nation, just because of the way the folks at the export facility talked about it. Given that, I think that's not such a bad transition to the Sustainable Aviation Fuels Conference here, where we've been talking with executives and hearing from them from the oil industry. Phillips was here, ExxonMobil is here, Citgo is in the audience, and the airline industry representatives from Boeing are here, United, American, Southwest. And I'm wondering, as you have been considering over the last day and a half, SAF, or Sustainable Aviation Fuel, and its move into this particular industry, if you have a feeling about how important it is to them, and whether it's alcohol-based SAF or oil-based SAF that they're more concerned about.
Definitely, it was, you know, it's the SAF Green Challenge that was put out by the Biden administration. So it's to use, I think it's a 10% blend by 2030, which, you know, that's not that far away. And then 100% by, or net zero by 2050. And earlier there was a panel with Delta, United, and American, and I believe Boeing too. And someone said, you know, are we on track to meet the SAF Green Challenge? And then everyone collectively said no, and then chuckled about it, because it definitely, we're, you know, we're just getting started and ramping up. And I think one of the biggest takeaways for me is that, you know, when we're in ag, we're thinking, we're kind of like tunnel vision, oh, ethanol to jet, or even thinking about the using a vegetable oil like soybean oil to make SAF as well. But the airline industry, they're looking at all of the different ways that they can potentially make it to decarbonize, because ag can be a huge part of that solution, but it's definitely not the only thing. They're looking at all sorts of different ways to arrive at being able to the production and then sourcing their needs.
Yeah, so I will admit, you and I were in that same panel discussion, and they did chuckle about it, but it was that we want to, but you know, 2 years ago we thought that was possible, and we're really worried about not being able to make that at this point.
A lot of things work on paper, but then the actual execution. And when we talk about, we talk about the, is it HEFA? I'm probably saying it wrong. But when we're looking at using vegetable oil or waste oil or fat or grease or something like that, you know, we are already spreading ourselves fairly thin in the global veg oil space because of this boom we've had in renewable diesel. And so then you end up having a competition for the same feedstock if you're looking at that in sustainable aviation fuel. So I think that's a lot of the reason that we're going this focus with corn ethanol, 1.6 gallons of corn ethanol to make 1 gallon of sustainable aviation fuel. And again, the biggest challenge there, and it's something that hasn't really came, it didn't really come up in the conversation here like it would in a more straight ag focused conference, but you know, corn ethanol, it's at this point, it doesn't qualify for those tax credits needed to incentivize its productions or make its production feasible under the IRA unless we have the carbon sequestration, so pipeline or on-site sequestration.
And so they did talk some about carbon sequestration, but not in conjunction with the need for it to be balanced out with the SAF made or alcohol to jet fuel. A couple of other questions. I got the feeling from everybody who's been up front, and it's mostly been the oil execs and the airline industry folks to this point, that this was not a if, but a how soon function for them. I'm wondering whether that's what you felt like you were hearing from them or not, too.
Yeah, it definitely, it seemed like the timeline is up in the air, and they're trying to move that direction, but the problem is and I think this was with Exxon, he had mentioned we're the bridge into market-based solutions, and so as we're moving from like a policy-driven situation into a real market, biggest hurdle being the cost. The airline industry, it's not a high margin business. And so when you're looking at bringing this new fuel, you know, everyone wants to go green, but someone has to pay for it. So it's trying to figure out how do we get from point A to point B economically. And right now there's, you know, like the reason that this conference is here in Illinois is because J.B. Pritzker signed into legislation this $1.50 per gallon tax credit, and it's a use credit. And so those airlines that are using sustainable aviation fuel, they're getting that $1.50 a gallon from the state of Illinois, and that actually it's a 10-year deal. So it's different than the IRA tax credits, which are incentivizing production and blending, but those only go out a few years. And so another one of the big kind of messages today, a recurring theme, was just that in order for airlines and industry to make these investments, they're going to have to see longer term policy that's supportive overall of sustainable aviation fuel.
One final note on the Sustainable Aviation Fuels Conference that I think I heard clearly from the oil industry representatives and from at least one of the airline representatives is that they view this as a transition for ethanol, corn-based ethanol, from the automobile to the airline and not particularly as additional ethanol production, at least certainly not to begin with.
Yeah, I previously, if you'd go back a year ago or something, I would have thought, oh, okay, we are losing ethanol demand here in the U.S. like crazy because of EVs, that sort of thing. And I know that that was the feeling that they were kind of putting out there. I distinctively remember Jeff Cooper with Renewable Fuels Association, though, bringing up the point to me a while back that we have an aging U.S. car fleet. You know, we're keeping cars on the road longer. And so although we are making this transition to electric, that we're still going to have a lot the need for internal combustion engines on the road, plus ethanol exports to countries that are putting new renewable fuel policies in place, but they don't necessarily have the capacity to make the ethanol themselves. But getting back to your original question, yes. And again, it's this 1.6 gallons of ethanol into 1 gallon of sustainable aviation fuel. Right now, we don't even know what 2 years, 5 years down the road looks like on the SAF demand side of things. And so I think it's really difficult to say what's this look like longer term for U.S. ethanol. But either way, it's a good thing for corn as long as we're able to overcome those hurdles with carbon intensity and such getting there.
Susan Stroud is with NobleAg.com. You can read more from her there, learn more about what she's learned here at the Sustainable Aviation Fuels Conference as well. Now let's turn our attention to Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net. Matt, you and your company have put out some prospective planting numbers. Can you tell me about what those look like ahead of this USDA report coming out next Thursday?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's very complicated this year, Todd. It always is, but this year was interesting to see the difference in the way corn penciled out better than soybeans last fall versus the way that these things pencil out right now, as the Farm Doc team, you know, has very well illustrated in articles they put out, where soybeans are beating corn right now. The problem was last fall, or good thing, I guess, is that last fall corn was penciling better than soybeans. So we feel like we quantified a lot of corn acres. When we look at last year's combination of 178 million or so, a little bit more than that, corn and beans, you'd think maybe that could get bumped up due to the fact that wheat acres are projected by us to be down maybe 3 million. But we feel like maybe cotton will get a million acres of the mix. And we kind of feel like maybe total planted acres could go down a little bit this year, mostly due to lack of profit margins. So we came in at 91.5 corn, 86.1 soybeans, and a big reason is that last year we were 11 million acre gap between the two. This year we feel like that's going to narrow quite a bit, but maybe not close to par given the fact that corn again looked so much better last fall.
Are you worried that USDA will come out, and this is a survey of farmers, with a set of numbers that will be drastically different than what you have projected? I'm going to guess not, because you have those projections, but there is always that possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be shocked. Let's just put it that way. I mean, the thing is that it is a survey-based approach. As of March 1, though, Todd, I'll tell you what, the market had not rallied yet. And if they asked producers at the end of February with that crop insurance price at $4.66, or, you know, $1.25 below a year ago, first of all, and second of all, a market that just couldn't catch a break for anything, I've got to think that the farmer mentality and enthusiasm for planting corn on March 1st was probably the lowest it had been in 3 or 4 years. And so, you know, there's a chance that maybe some of that could swing around a little bit. But if it's 93 plus, it is what it is. It's a planting intentions number. We've got to wait until June planted acreage to get a better handle on things. But no doubt about it, they'll trade it. We'll take a very close look at it, and then we'll move on from there and see what kind of spring we have.
What are you telling producers at this point about new crop in particular and the things that they should be and might be doing?
Yeah, and so we've told producers, if your break even is above the market, we certainly understand hesitancy to doing anything from a risk management standpoint. Obviously, cash sales don't look all that attractive in that situation. But at the same time, your main risk at this point, Todd, is a move between here in this 470 level, you know, and down to, for instance, your crop insurance level. If it's 85%, 85% of 466, about 396 and a half. And so, you know, you've got a lot of meat on the bone, so to speak, still, as far as how much could we lose from our profitability. And so we've been trying to tell folks, setting a floor in under the market to protect a potential move between where we're at today and $4 or below certainly is a smart thing to do. And if you need to have some flexibility there, you can always do so. A lot of different ways whenever it comes to options. I'd like to be able to participate in a rally at least a 5.5, maybe 570. But at the same time, I'm willing to give up a little bit of that if it's able to ratchet up that floor as close to where the market is today as possible.
And for soybean?
Soybeans would be a similar discussion. I would say this, old crop beans, new crop beans, guys on our team seem to think we've got a really good shot at filling some gaps. Old crop beans, those things are clear up at $13, Todd. I don't know that I'm not that bullish, but as a team, we all feel like we could continue to see some strength, especially if you stay wet in Argentina, if you stay in a situation where U.S. beans continue to be a pleasant surprise as far as exports are concerned. So as far as new crop beans go, I think you get to that level. You've been back, you closed back over $12 there on Thursday. You know, if you get back to a level where you can sell $12 out of the field, I think we'd be crazy if we didn't at least reward the market with some sales there.
Anything else that you want to make sure that producers understand about the new crop that we haven't discussed today?
Yeah, I think overall what we have to understand is that the fundamentals suggest we could look at drastically lower prices than what we currently see. Last time we saw carryout as big as what we're looking at today, or 2 billion or above, was 2018, and the average marketing price, I believe, was 361. So we have to understand the fundamentals suggest that we could move a lot lower. So I would respect rallies, but I'd keep my flexibility by all means.
Matt Bennett is with AgMarket.net. Merrill Crowley is with AgTraderTalk.com. Hello, Merrill. Thank you for joining me. I appreciate that much. I'd like to take up a couple of other things with you. Matt discussed new crop, corn and soybeans. The old crop, corn and soybeans, will be impacted by what's been happening in Brazil. And if I could take that up with you first today, that would be where I'd like to start. Can you tell me about your thoughts as it's related to the crops there and the size and how USDA might yet handle some of those numbers?
I don't think the USDA is going to move much on the numbers. It might be surprising. Here's what's kind of set up that kind of is interesting to me, and I haven't really been seeing this anywhere else. All through the winter, the Brazilian commercials have locked themselves into a bunch of take-or-pay commitments of what is being referred to as huge tonnage outstanding for some months out front. So take-or-pay means if you don't use the port to load a certain tonnage onto a vessel at a specified time, and if you don't, you have to pay a very steep penalty. Now, we fast forward in time, and the Brazilian farmer is selling some beans, but not a huge amount. And a big chunk of what he's selling actually is for next year, 2025. So the crushers have a hot margin and are buying most of the new beans out from under the exporter. In the meantime, the Chinese are short premium as well. Everything's looking good when Brazil premiums broke a dollar over the board to a dollar under the board from the Middle East to the end of January. Then problems started to develop. The Brazil basis started to rally, and today is a dollar off those January lows. The Brazil farmer, once harvest began, is now said to have delivered some 6 million metric tons of unpriced soybeans to the elevator. Who took them, despite the fact that the Brazilian cash market's out of carry? Now, Grain Trading 101 says never, ever, ever take unpriced soybeans from the farmer in a carry market. For the exporter, those unpriced beans are a good chunk of the stock he has available to load his boats with to China. So the exporter is shipping a bunch of unpriced beans, hoping the basis goes down again. Now they're halfway through harvest. They're over 63%, I think, harvested. Well, between 50 and 75, your basis tends to continue to improve. We'll have to see it, of course. So he's trying to cover this trade cheaper, and he's competing with the Chinese who are short, and that the Brazilian farmer, much like his American counterpart, is unhappy with current prices, and he's not pricing them. So now we've got people in a bind. What usually happens in the market when you have people in a bind? The market usually goes the other way and makes them pay. We go back to 2016, and in that year, July soybeans bottomed at 850 at the end of February, then rallied up to 1208 by the beginning of June. So a $3.50 rally. Now, was it due to that? I would say no, it wasn't all due to that. And then these sideways range, they were a 5 cent carry back then. And then what they do, that eventually went to a 70 cents inverse in 2016. So they normally buy July and sell November as a spread to protect themselves. So we've got some people caught in a bind that could really develop into something interesting down the road. The other thing that I see, and this is not necessarily Brazil, is we're talking about the shorts in the marketplace and that they are covering their shorts, the big funds. And so according to what you look at, if you look at open interest, we've added 100,000 contracts to the corn open interest. That would suggest that that's new buying, not short covering. So with new longs coming in and the end of the quarter coming on, again, we've got another situation where people are stuck in a short position, and it may turn out to be beneficial for the farmer, regardless of what the report at the end of the month says. Now, the end of the month report may push us one direction or another for a short while. Excuse me. But unless they can cover these positions, you're going to have some buying in the market that's going to help support it for some time to come, I would think.
So going to back to the beginning of the story, so if the Brazilian farmer is unpriced and the exporter, ABCDs, are unpriced.
And the Chinese are short bought.
And Chinese are short bought. Is it, if the farmer's unpriced, they probably will be okay as the price goes up. However, it is the place where the squeeze is on is with the ADMs, the Cargills, and the Bungies or the exporters?
Well, that's what this guy is referring to, is all with the exporters, as far as they have shipped grain unpriced in a carry market, and now somehow I've got to cover that with the farmer that they bought it from. That might explain why we're seeing such a long position with commercials on the board of trade.
Does it portend a spike, a quick spike up that producers will need to take advantage of?
I don't think it's a quick spike necessarily. And it depends on what you want to say quick. I would say it's something that could happen in a month's time.
But much sooner rather than later. In the next month?
Well, they got to cover it fairly soon, somehow.
What's the next question?
Well, it's not necessarily a question per se. So I'm looking at this and I'm trying to put this in place, like you're asking the question, what is it really going to do? And as you know, I'm more technical than I am fundamental. And I'm looking at this, and right now I see a really nice upward pattern in corn and beans. And it's a five-wave pattern, which is usually what they call impulse. Impulse means it's going in the direction of the it's a direction in the trend that's is dominant. However, with Elliott Wave, you can get your five waves up, you can have three waves down, another five waves up, and it's done. And then you resume the trend, which was a downtrend earlier, at least in this situation. I hope that's clear enough. So I think we may have seen the peak of our current rally, and we're going to back off. Well, if we're going to back off, that means it shouldn't get too awful low, right? I mean, you're going to have these commercials, and you're going to have the Chinese trying to cover their short positions, correct?
Correct.
So so I could see this thing going back down. Where to? That's a $100 question. There's really good support for corn around 465. That's a new crop, by the way. And then for beans, there's really good support around, let's see, the 1175 area, down to 1158. But that's kind of the way I see this market working. We may close the day and be up, and that just wipes out everything I said. But that's kind of what I'm looking at in the markets with that and the technicals. Now, the other thing we had talked about briefly at the all-day ag outlook meeting was looking at these total ending stocks of all these countries. And we're talking about all the beans that we have coming in from Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, and the U.S. Ending stocks right now, as of the last report we had here in March, are at 68.12 million metric ton. And that's the total for U.S., Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil. Now, you look back, you can go to 2020, where that ending stocks figure was 71.22. With all these beans on hand compared to what we had in 2020, it's kind of interesting that our ending stocks are only being placed 3 million metric tons shorter, and the fact that it's even shorter. So where are all our beans going? Well, crush is one. China's not really slowing up. We hear all this rhetoric from China that they're slowing up on their purchases and their demand. But you dig down into the figures, and they're not.
Through the crush? I don't know.
So do they have more of a problem than what they're letting on? It just seems to me like some things are here that beg the question of, is this going to be a short-lived rally and they're over with? I kind of think that with all the noise we're hearing from everybody, that this thing could go a little bit longer than what everybody's thinking. And I don't know what Matt had to say about the new crop situation, that's kind of where I'm at. I'm starting to lean a little bullish, and I'm going to be on. If this is a retracement, like I believe it is, then I'm going to be a buyer down here to set the farmers up for some decent move higher. As we said in 2016, and no 2 years are alike, of course, we got a $3.50 rally from the lows, where our lows are 11.22.
Merrill Crowley is with AgTraderTalk.com. Let's turn our attention to Old Crop directly with Jim McCormick. He's at AgMarket.net. Hello, Jim. Thank you for taking some time on this Friday morning with me to discuss what's been happening with the Old Crop. Farmers clearly have been lagging behind in sales, both of corn and soybeans. They made some going into that March 1st time frame, and now they've watched the market rally for the better part of 3 weeks. What are they telling you about their marketing situation today and what their hopes might be?
Well, there's no doubt about it, Todd. There was a lot of producers, unfortunately, that had grain in elevators primarily that washed out them their, you know, those positions right there at going into first notice day of the March contract. The guys that did not have to get forced out seem to be a little bit more tight-fisted. We have seen a little bit of producer selling pickup on the old crop and actually a little bit of a new crop on this run-up, over the last couple of weeks. But in general, Todd, I think you're going to see even on the square of the grain stocks that the farmer actually has quite a bit of grain on hand still. And, it's still put them in a very tough financial position. We need higher prices to get them closer to break even or better. But that's also part of the problem, because when we do get to short covering rallies, we've got so much old crop grain that needs to be moved by the farmer. It's unfortunately capping maybe some of the upward momentum.
What are you telling them that they ought to be doing at this time, if you're in the belief that it might cap this momentum and maybe they come back to you and say, but I can hang on till May, June?
Well, right now, I'm always leery about this crop report in the next week. The quarterly grain stock acreage numbers, it really seems to be just a massive wow. You get the number and you go. There's really no analytical about it. So you're kind of trying to guess what the government's going to say as an industry. And then on top of it, Todd, you're trying to guess how the industry is going to react to what the government says. And sometimes maybe the best thing to do is just sit tight, but they use a little bit of a protection plan defense. And what I mean by that is we're encouraging producers to consider maybe buying some of the shorter time framed options. You know, there are options now that you can buy that expire every Friday. There'll be short dated options. So you can lay off some of that risk, buy options that'll actually expire the day of the report or maybe the week after the report. That'll give you some protection on that unsold grain in case we do get a bearish reaction to the report, but also allow you to participate if we happen to get a bullish reaction to the report.
For soybeans, where do you stand on old crop sales there as related to what's left in the bin?
Right now, you know, our group's been pretty aggressive getting stuff sold. I mean, right now, if you look at the beans at the moment, they've had a heck of a run off their low. They've almost rallied a dollar. We did just shy of about a 38% retracement on the May corn, the May bean side. You go from your high made on November 15th to your low made pretty much right there on February 29th. A 38% retracement's right there at 1238. I've got some clients I'm recommending trying to sell some beans there. I definitely would argue you get near the 100-day, 1269 is 100-day. The 50% retracement of the May trading sell-off on the May contracts, 1273. So that is going to be some major resistance. If you've got unpriced bushels, I would definitely use that as a price target. And if you got those very last gambling bushels, if we're lucky enough, maybe we go fill that gap. To fill that gap, you got to go to 1307. But I think that is going to be an awful big ask unless we have a weather problem this spring.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. You may listen to the whole of the program anytime you'd like at willag.org, willag.org. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Matt Bennett from agmarket.net, Jim McCormick from that same company, along with Merrill Crowley of agtradertalk.com, and special thanks to Susan Stroud of nobleag.com, who joined me here at the Sustainable Aviation Fuels Conference in Lisle. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.